Have you ever felt a twinge of worry about AI taking over your job or diluting your creativity? Well, what if you could turn that fear into creative fuel? We've just published an amazing new ebook called The 4 Keys to Success in an AI World, and this is more than just a guide. It's a deep exploration into the human skills that AI can't touch, the skills that are essential for standing out and thriving no matter how much technology evolves. We're talking about real differentiators here like creativity, emotional intelligence, critical thinking, and much more. Inside, you'll find actionable insights and strategies to develop these skills, whether you're a creative person, a business person, or just simply someone who loves personal development. This isn't a story about tech taking over. It's a story of human creativity thriving alongside AI. Picture this: AI as your creative co-pilot, not just as a tool, but a collaborator that enhances your unique human skills. The 4 Keys ebook will show you exactly how to do that and view AI in a new way that empowers you instead of overshadows you. Transform your creative potential today. Head over to unmistakablecreative.com/4keys. Use the number 4, K-E-Y-S. That's unmistakablecreative.com/4keys. And download your free copy.
What I say to them is, if you think about the metric of money, this all-important measure of success, if I were to say to you, here's a job that's going to pay you a lot more money, but you'll have less vacation. So the only vacations you're going to take are those nice little weekends to cosmopolitan cities. You'd be like, great, awesome. If I were to ask you that, if you were the guy who wants to wake up at the stream, you'd be like, no, that's not going to work for me. In fact, I'd rather have less money, but more vacation, because those far, you know, out camping places are actually harder to get to. And so, you know, we look at these metrics and we say, okay, well, I know on paper, those are the metrics that matter, but they don't actually matter to me. And so I can fill in those checkboxes and I can make the money, but I'm not really happy. And so the whole book is written with this idea of giving people a framework to actually be able to think about changing up the scorecard and making it a scorecard that works for them, particularly wonderfully, quirkily them, as opposed to everybody else's scorecard.
I'm Srini Rao, and this is the Unmistakable Creative Podcast, where you get a window into the stories and insights of the most innovative and creative minds who've started movements, built thriving businesses, written best-selling books, and created insanely interesting art. For more, check out our 500-episode archive at unmistakablecreative.com.
Life is full of awesome what ifs, and some not so much, like unexpected medical costs. That's why United Healthcare provides Health Protector Guard fixed indemnity insurance plans to supplement your primary plan and help manage out-of-pocket costs. Learn more at uh1.com.
This is Paige, the co-host of Giggly Squad, and I want to tell you about a company that I've been loving, Olive and June. Olive and June gives you everything that you need for a salon-quality manicure in one box. And if you break it down, it really comes out to $2 a manicure, which is absolutely insane. It's also so easy to get salon-worthy nails at home with Olive and June. The difference between how your nails used to look when you did them yourself and now with the Manny system is a complete game changer. The best thing about Olive and June, too, is it's a quick dry. It dries in about 1 minute, lasts for 5 days, and full coverage in up to 1 to 2 coats. Visit oliveandjune.com/perfectmanny20 for 20% off your first system. That's oliveandjune.com/perfectmanny20 for 20% off your first system.
Ever catch yourself eating the same flavorless dinner 3 days in a row? Dreaming of something better? Well, HelloFresh is your guilt-free dream come true, baby. It's me, Keke Palmer. Let's wake up those taste buds with hot, juicy pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Mm. HelloFresh. Stop dreaming of all the delicious possibilities and dig in at HelloFresh.com. Let's get this dinner party started.
Life is full of awesome what ifs, and some not so much, like unexpected medical costs. That's why United Healthcare provides Health Protector Guard fixed indemnity insurance plans to supplement your primary plan and help manage out-of-pocket costs. Learn more at uh1.com.
Hey, it's Ryan Reynolds, and I'm here with Keith, co-star of my upcoming film, If, only in theaters May 17th. Do you want to tell people the big news? All right, I'll do. Sign up now and you'll get unlimited for $15 a month and 6 months of Paramount Plus Essential Plan on us.
Mintmobile.com/switch.
Upfront payment of $45 equivalent to $15 per month. Unlimited over 40 gigabytes per month. Face lower speeds. Videos at 480p. Active Mint customers by 5/31/24 get 6 months of Paramount Plus Essential Plan. Auto renews after 6 months. Offer ends May 31st, 2024. Separate Paramount Plus registration required. Terms and conditions apply if rated PG.
As creators, we're always on the move. Whether it's a live podcast event, a pop-up shop, or a workshop, we're constantly interacting with community, and that's where Tap to Pay on iPhone and Stripe comes in. Imagine this. You're at a live event, a listener loves your merch, or a participant wants to sign up for your course on the spot. With Tap to Pay on iPhone and Stripe, you can accept their payments right there and then, right from your iPhone, so there's no extra hardware or no delays. Total game changer. It's not just for creators. Any business owner can do this. It's about making transactions smoother and much more personal, growing your business in your way. We've been using Stripe for our products and courses for a long time, and now with Tap to Pay on iPhone, you can take your business to the next level too. So visit stripe.com/tapiphone to learn more. Remember, folks, with Tap to Pay on iPhone and Stripe, your business is always at your fingertips. Laura, welcome to the Unmistakable Creative. Thanks so much for taking the time to join us.
Hey, thank you for having me.
Yeah, so I actually was introduced to you by way of your publicist who sent me your book, Limitless. And I remember just as I sat down with this book, I couldn't help but underline so much. And I was like, wow, I feel like I'm hearing the sound of my own voice echoed in so much of what you're saying, because I've said so many similar things. So it really struck a chord with me. But before we get into the book and your work and all of that, I want to start by asking you, what is one of the most important things that you learned from one or both of your parents that have influenced and shaped who you've become and what you've done with your life?
Oh, gosh, that's such a great question. And I love it because like you were hearing yourself in my book, I hear myself in that. I spent 20 years doing executive search for nonprofit organizations. And the thing about doing executive search for nonprofits is that you don't necessarily have to know what or how somebody accomplished something, but you really need to know why. Because nobody's in that work for the glory or the fame or the big paycheck. They're in it because there was a mother, a father, a teacher, a person of faith, a diagnosis, a world catastrophe, something that set their life in a completely different direction suddenly one day. And so I always started by asking people about something that they learned from somebody along the way. And it might have been a parent or it might have been, you know, some other mentor person in their life. But I always ask that question because it's a great way to start people talking about the thing they know best, right, themselves. But also you really get an insight into who they are and what they choose. So I've never had that question asked of me. And now I feel a little nervous and self-conscious, but I will tell you, I think what I probably learned from both of my parents, who themselves were parents of immigrants, themselves were children of immigrants, is that there are soft rules and there are hard rules. You know, I mean, there's like the hard rules, like you can't murder people, but there are soft rules, like nobody is necessarily telling you what you can or can't do. And you have to stop waiting for permission in life for things. Mm-hmm. So sometimes, you know, you can be a little pushy and, you know, somebody's going to ask, somebody's going to get something. Someone's got to be, you know, under the oak tree with Oprah on Super Soul Sunday, right? Like, why not you? It's got to be someone. And so I think I probably learned early on that if there's something that you really want in life, you're going to be the one who's going to have to go out and get it.
Mm-hmm. So you mentioned that they were both children of immigrants. So I can't help but wonder this because I'm a child of immigrant parents. And I wonder, you know, in that environment, what are the things that you were taught about careers? And the reason I ask this is because you say the only definition of success that counts is yours and yours alone. And the only way to be truly limitless is to journey along your very own life's path. But having grown up in an immigrant family, I know how counter that goes, what you just said, to what it's like to grow up as an immigrant, because immigrant parents come here with this idea that, okay, we came with nothing. Our job is to basically provide you security and ensure that you don't end up a giant screw up in life. So how do you have those two things coexist? And what did your parents tell you about careers?
Yeah, well, I think, you know, I think that's really true. And, you know, when I was growing up, I was told, you know, you become a doctor, a lawyer, a teacher, an accountant. There are professions, right? There are careers and there are professions. And they track very neatly to majors in college and graduate school. And at the same time, as a woman, I was also getting messages like, and marry a nice Jewish doctor. Right? So it was a little bit of go to graduate school, be your own person, have a career, but also you're not completely successful till you've sort of checked this box. And I talk a lot, you know, I, as you know, I do a lot of public speaking and I'm, you know, make my living as a keynote speaker. And I get on stage and I talk about how my definition of success that I've been carrying around in my back pocket since I was little came from lots of places. And one of them is this idea that, you know, you should be a lawyer, right? You should have a career. And I go to law school and I hate law school. The first week I turn around and I'm like, I'm in the worst place. This doesn't make any sense for me. I don't want to be here. And so I drop out and then I join a presidential campaign. And the only thing that saved me from my parents' wrath is that I was, I think at the time, dating the man of my mother's dreams, which was he came in the form of a 6'2" medical student named Alan, who came from a good family and belonged to a nice temple. And the problem with Alan was that every time I kissed him, all I could think of was milk, butter, cheese, eggs. Like, I got to pick up the dry cleaning. I got to get my groceries. It was just, there was no spark. And I would tell my grandmother the story of me and No Spark Alan about how, like, there was nothing there. And she would just look at me and she'd be like, you just need to concentrate. Right? Because that was success. Like, how could I possibly let the perfect man, the perfect definition of success, slip through my fingers? That was the whole reason that my parents put me in these places, so I could meet the man of their dreams. And so I think there is this moment where you turn around and you're like, okay, so I've done it. I checked all the right boxes along everybody else's path to everybody else's version of success. And I'm living a life that on paper looks right. But it doesn't feel right. And it doesn't feel right because it's not right for me. Like, I was living my parents' life and my grandparents' life. And there comes a moment when you go, okay, so I'm successful, but I'm not happy. And why can't we have both? And that's the moment when you just have to say, well, am I willing to eat ramen soup for 6 months while I figure it out, while I take a completely different path? Like, what are the things that I can do that can look maybe to the outside world like somehow they're, you know, credible as I'm making the leap from the traditional acceptable by immigrant parents and grandparents experience, both for them and their fear and what they came from, but also, you know, their social circles as well. And then in living into the life that I really want for myself.
Wow. Do you have siblings?
I have a sister.
And are you the older or the younger?
I'm the younger. She's 16 months older than I am.
Okay. What do you think was the difference in the messages that you both got? Do you think things changed with you? Because my ongoing joke is that if you're the child of immigrants, I think this is applicable to any parents, immigrants or not. The first kid is the experiment. Everything you screw up on the first kid, you fix on the second. And I'll give you context. I remember very distinctly when I got to seventh grade, my parents thought I had turned into this horrible human being because I wanted nice shoes. I wanted expensive shirts. And we couldn't afford any of it. When my sister got to seventh grade, my parents had been through all of this whole popular kid nonsense before. So it was completely normal to them. And so I wonder, in your own experience, what that was like.
But was that also a boy-girl thing, too? Do they have different expectations of her because she was a girl?
I don't know. Here's the thing. I know that, like, that's actually a good question, because I remember when the dentist told my dad that I needed braces, he was like, yeah, that's bullshit. His teeth are fine. When he told my dad my sister needed braces, he was like, yeah, fine, get her braces. So maybe, yeah, to some degree.
Yeah, I mean, girls are supposed to curtsy and be pretty. you got to work your power muscle, right? You got the moneymaker.
Yeah. I always wonder, like, you know, when you have, two siblings, whether the younger one gets a different narrative in an immigrant family. And maybe it's not just a boy-girl thing. Because I've seen it, you know, even with people who are, you know, two brothers or two sisters.
So I don't know about that. It's really interesting. I think that I would say that my parents were exceptionally difficult on me and expected a ton. Now, my sister was 16 months older and my cousin also grew up in our house and she was a couple years older than her. My cousin would tell you that my parents were really hard on her, and by the time they got to me, she'd already broken their spirit. So I think it really all depends, you know, where you stand always is dictated by where you sit. And I think that based on birth order, I sure felt like they'd perfected their parenting and being tough by the time they got to me. And they would probably say exactly the opposite was their experience. I think we always think people are harder on us than everyone else around us. I mean, that's just probably a narrative. We think everybody's staring at us and talking about us. But I don't know. I also grew up, I'm Gen X, so I grew up with parents that were like the benign neglect type of parents. You know, they weren't, they were there and they provided for us and they loved us and life was great, but they weren't helicopter parents. They weren't jumping in and solving our problems. And so I think maybe by the time I came along, my parents had already seen enough other problems from my cousin and my sister. But by the time I got there, they maybe knew how to jump in a little earlier, or maybe knew how to help, or maybe could head things off a little bit more because they just had more time in. I don't really know. My sister was also very much the popular girl. She, like you, you know, she was popular. I was only a year behind her in school and all of my male friends had crushes on her. You know, I went back for my 10-year high school reunion and some of my best guy friends were like, "You're pretty. Were you always pretty in high school?" And I was like, "Yeah, I pretty much look exactly the same." And thanks. Like they didn't, you know, I was a nerd. I went to computer sleepaway camp. Like my mother once told me I was the smart one. By the way, mothers of daughters, if you're listening, don't ever say that to your daughter. It was meant obviously as a huge compliment that I was intelligent. But you know, when you're 15 years old and all you want is that boy to pay attention to you and then you're told you're smart. Yeah, it wasn't great. So, I think we were just different human beings and I think we had different expectations out of life. And I think that everything, all the choices that we've made since have reflected that. It's just who we are as people. And I've always been, you know, my sister was the kind of person, we joke around, her name is Karen, and we joke around, here comes Karen, like Karen walks in and suddenly all of first class empties out and everybody can get an upgrade. Or, you know, she walks in and it's like everything in the store goes on sale. She just, things just happen. She has this luck in life and has always had that and has worked really hard also. So, you know, I think luck happens when you work really hard and it happens to be there. But I was always the kid who chose the harder way, you know, like I chose the nerdy club as opposed to the popular club. I chose debate as opposed to, you know, student council. Like I always chose the harder way. And I was the kid who always put super heavy rocks in my backpack and then, you know, tied one leg behind my back and hopped up the mountain, where she just like found someone to carry her. You know, it was really interesting. And I remember her turning to me once when I was in high school and saying, you know, you don't have to make it always so hard. And I don't know how much it was the parents and how they raised us and birth order and all of that, or just how much of it was her personality. And she was just always somebody who could see the easier path and take it. Whereas I would see the easier path and I would think for some reason that was selling out or it was terrible or it was wrong. And I would resent her and other people for taking it. When what I realize now is sometimes the easier path is just the easier path and that's okay.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I don't think I've ever heard anybody describe parenting as benign neglect.
Chris, yeah. My parents are going to listen to this and I'm going to get a phone call now.
Well, it's funny because when you heard that, when you said that, I suddenly thought, you know, I was like, okay, you know what? My parents weren't, you know, like as bad as I thought I made them out to be. I'm like, yeah, I would call that benign neglect. They were busy, you know?
Yeah, I would consider my own parenting benign neglect too. You know, I actually love the parenting style of benign neglect. I feel like your kids should learn how to solve their own problems. When my kids come to me, they tell me they're bored. I'm like, great. Uh-huh. I'm sure you can solve that problem. Go. Come back when dinner is on the table. And by the way, come back a little before because you're going to help cook it, right? Like I really believe that not being the solution to all of your children's problems is going to serve them well in life. Now, our kids have to have something to complain about to their psychotherapist. So maybe that will be the thing they complain about me. But I do believe that my children are better human beings because I am less present in their life all the time, if that makes sense.
Yeah. Well, it's funny you say that, you know, the idea of, you know, I'm bored. And I remember, my guess is just from talking to you, we're probably close in age. When I would tell my dad that, it was like, yeah, great. Go do something. Like, well, this is not my problem to solve.
I told my dad that once. I made the huge mistake of telling my father that I was bored right after he'd come home from a long day of work. I was like, "Dad, I'm bored." And he goes, "Good." He goes, "Hey, go get me a piece of paper and a pencil." And I was like, "Oh, okay. He's going to give me stuff to do. Yay." And I go back and I give him a piece of paper and a pencil. And he spends like 5 minutes writing on this paper, like writing and writing and writing and writing. I'm like getting all excited. And then he hands me the piece of paper. And the piece of paper is a giant list of like 30 numbers. And he goes, "Here, go add these up." That was it. He gave me math. I told him I was bored. And he gave me arithmetic. Guess how many times I told him I was bored. Yeah, I never told him I was bored again. Never. That was it. He taught me well.
Wow. Well, you know, one of the things I want to ask you about is education, just because it, particularly as a parent, you know, there's something you say at the very beginning of the book. You say, we're all limited, women and men both, to measuring our progress by how fast and how high we climb. We're limited by the imaginations and burdens of others. We're limited by their opinions about who we are and where we belong. We are so limited by checking off the boxes of other people's versions of success that we forget to determine our own. And that really just kind of hit me hard. It was one of those things that literally, I think that was the line that made me think, okay, yeah, absolutely. I want to have this person as a guest because I wanted to ask you just about that one very thing. And I wonder, both having, you know, been raised by parents who are immigrants, having children of your own, and having said something like that, what are your thoughts on how you're going to educate your kids? And how do you have this worldview coexist with a modern education system, which in my mind, in a lot of ways, is very contrary to what you've said?
So I've kind of screwed myself because I wrote a book that has a subtitle, How to Ignore Everybody. So the other day I was, you know, lecturing my kids about something and my sassy 14-year-old was like, so is this a thing we're supposed to ignore? So, you know, maybe that's going to be a problem. Maybe that's going to come back to haunt me. I don't know. We'll see. You know, yeah. I was asked the other day on a podcast about the advice that I would give my 22-year-old self. And I stopped for a second. And I was like, the advice I would give my 22-year-old self over a podcast that's being recorded on the internet, that's being listened to on a cell phone. Like none of those things existed when I was 22. And so I think, yeah, the advice I'm giving is contrary to the modern education system, but I think the world changes around us so fast that even if we know ourselves, like even if my kids who are 14 and 16 right now know who they are and know what they want out of life, the world around them is going to change so much. You know, my older son is fascinated by NASA. He's the kid who sits in his 10th grade class and in the corner of his laptop watches the entirety of a 12-hour spacewalk. And wow. He comes home and I'm like, were your other friends interested? Did you talk to them all about lunch? He's like, no, it was just me. No one cared. He's so interested in this that he wants to take all STEM classes. And I mean, he wants to build international space stations. Now, 20 years from now, will there be international space stations or are we going to be building outposts on Mars? Who knows, right? The world is going to be different. And so even if he knows what he wants to do today, it's going to change around him. And so I think that the advice that I'm giving to people is not to spend all of their time pursuing a very specific and very defined idea that's going to change, and to really think about what are the things that they like to do and where do they get a lot of energy and where are they at their best, and spending time there. Because I think, you know, titles and jobs are not portable, but skill sets and interests are.
Wow. So let's shift gears a little bit and actually start talking about your work. But what I want to do is kind of talk about how you actually ended up getting to this point and how this worldview was shaped by the work that you did in the nonprofit world.
Yeah, I would love to tell that story as if it was super strategic and that I had a plan and I executed on my goals and everything worked out perfectly. But it's not the case. I mean, every major career junction that I had was an accident and, you know, luck, right? Where the hard work and an opportunity appeared and I was able to take it because of the work that I'd put in. So every transition I had in my career was the like 25 years that lead up to being an overnight success type of thing. I say that because I think that there are so many people who are busy doing things like promoting books that try to think, you know, show that they have it all and they know it all and that everything's perfect. And I just think it does a disservice to the rest of humanity for any of us to pretend like we know what the hell we're doing. Because I don't think any of us, I mean, I don't know that any of us really do. I think there are things that we do in life where we're like, unimpeachably, this is something I do well. And then there's like the rest of the 98% of our day where we're like, I'm kind of making it up as we go along. Like parenting, right? Who knows?
Wow. I think that, you know, you actually mentioned this idea of nonlinear when you mentioned, you know, the people that you've interviewed that had the most interesting career paths. And people are always like, you know, what are the common patterns between people you've interviewed? I'm like, there's one that's always common, and it's how they got here was anything but linear. It's like just zigging and zagging and detours and dead ends and, you know, all sorts of crazy shit that you would have never imagined is like, you know, what a career path looks like. And yet I think that we're very much raised and educated to believe that life is linear because of the fact that the way we're educated is linear. So how do you resolve that paradox when you get into adult life? Or what would you tell people who are looking to resolve that paradox?
Well, I would say first and foremost, I think you're absolutely right. I mean, in 20 years of interviewing people, and remember, I was interviewing people for CEO positions of major international nonprofit organizations, foundations, universities. I was interviewing people who were successful, right? Capital S, successful, at the top of their game. And here's what I learned about every single one of them. They all failed at some point. They all had U-turns and right turns and left turns. And it was in those U-turns and left turns and right turns where they became interesting human beings, right? You don't develop character with success. You develop character through failure. And I never really looked for subject matter expertise. I'm a firm believer that anybody can learn anything from a book, right? Mm-hmm. But in order to do that, and in order to be successful at it, you need five things. And that's hunger, weight, tenacity, speed, and grit. So hunger, right? The desire, just the outright desire to do more, know more, be more. Weight. How serious of a human being are you, right? Can I put you in front of my biggest client? Can I put you in front of my biggest donor? Can I put you in front of my biggest account and know that you're going to represent me well and take it seriously? Tenacity. Just how many times are you willing to get up over and over and over again after you fail and learn more? Speed. How fast from failure to fix, right? Just how quick does your brain work? And then grit. Just how tough are you? You know, how much are you willing to take it on the chin in order to do the thing that you care about deeply? And when I would see people who had those five things as demonstrated through personal experience or professional experience, I was like, yeah, this is the person at 2 a.m. when the shit hits the fan that's going to show up and be the guy, the girl that I want, right? This is the person who's the right person for this job. Because it's not just that they've got on paper the right work. They have consonants. They like the what they do matches who they are, and they bring everything they want to this thing because it's all aligned. And so that's really what I looked for in people. And I think for me, that's reflected in my own career because it meant that, you know, going back to this, what I learned from my parents, it means that at every career shift I've had, you know, the next job was always something that I had absolutely no qualifications for because that's why it interests me, right? If I'm super qualified for it, it's because I'd already done it before. So I was not really ever qualified, but it was like, yeah, that seems interesting. I'm going to do that. And I knew that I could bring hunger, weight, tenacity, speed, and grit to doing it. So whether it was dropping out of law school and joining a presidential campaign, whether it was walking into the White House at, you know, 22 years old, you know, presidential appointee, helping build AmeriCorps, you know, going to this big search firm, having my moment of rage, starting my own firm, getting on a stage and starting to public speak, writing this book, whatever it was, every career shift was like, huh, that seems interesting. Let's try that now. And it wasn't that I had confidence that I would be successful at the thing. I had confidence in my own discipline that I would bring everything that it took to get better at the thing that was needed. Hmm.
So I want to go into the idea of consonance. Before we do that, I didn't want to let it go that you mentioned working on a presidential campaign. And I wonder from something like that, what you learned about human behavior, relationships, and accomplishing something as big as, you know, succeeding at getting elected to the highest office in the country.
Well, I learned
which I'm sure we could have an hour conversation about that.
Where do you want to start on that? So I'll tell you two things I learned. First is that I believe that charisma is absolutely an innate quality. I think that there are people who just have it in a way that is gravitationally shifting to the world. You know, Bill Clinton would walk into a room, he'd be in the back of a room of 4,000 people and not say a word. And all of a sudden, every person in the room would turn around. I mean, he just had this this energy, this magnetism that people talk about. And I believe it's still there. And even now, he's older, you know, he seems like he's ailing. And he's a vegan now, so he's like all skinny. You talk to him and he looks like an old man, but when you look him in the eyes, there's the fire and the energy is still there in his eyes in a way that when he moves on to the next person to talk to them, you still feel them burning into your soul. It's a fascinating thing. And even people who don't agree with his politics say the same thing about him. I mean, it's just, so I believe that there is this charisma. So that's the first. The second is that I also learned that even if you don't have that kind of charisma, there are people who create relationships that are so deep and so bonding that you might not necessarily be the leader who's out front in the spotlight, whose name is bold-faced, but there are people in this world who are behind the scenes who are just as much leaders. So yes, I worked for Bill Clinton, but I also had the great opportunity to work for a man named Eli Siegel. And Eli ran the 92 campaign and then could have had any job he wanted to in the entire world. He could have been ambassador to France, you know, like great, easy, cushy jobs. But he wanted to create AmeriCorps. And this idea of community service in exchange for college tuition was actually the reason I dropped out of law school and joined the Clinton campaign. And I went to go work for Eli on day two. Now, on day one, I was brought into the White House. A friend of mine I'd met on the campaign trail was running the volunteer operations. And he's like, hey, we need somebody in this office to answer these calls. And I don't want to, you know, slander anybody, so I'm not going to give you the name. But I went into the office on the first day for this person who ended up becoming a pretty well-known, bold-faced individual. And I'm, you know, sitting there, I'm, you know, 22. I don't know my head from my ass. I'm literally wearing my mother's hand-me-down search suits with like the Alexis Carrington, you know, dynasty shoulder pads. And I'm looking at this enormous phone with like 8 billion buttons and the phone rings. And I was like, hello. And, you know, I say the guy's name, this is his office. And the woman on the other end of the phone is like, is he in? This is his mother. Now, I'm like, oh, this is the very first phone call, the very first day, 12:01, right after inauguration. And I'm like, hold on a minute, please. And I take the phone and I look at all the buttons and I'm just like, I'll just put the handle next to the phone because I was so afraid I was going to disconnect this guy's mom. And I tiptoe into his office and I was like, excuse me, sir, your mother's on line one. And he's sitting there. This is back before the internet. So, you know, the news came out on a daily basis with like photocopies of major newspaper stories, and we call them the clips. And he's sitting there with his feet up on the desk, flipping through the clips. And he's like, oh, tell her I'm really busy. I'll call her later. Okay. So I tiptoe back and I pick up the phone and I'm like, excuse me, ma'am. He said he needs to call you back later. He's really busy. Okay, thank you. And I hang up the phone. And that afternoon, I walked down to the volunteer office and I talked to my friend Patrick and I was like, I would rather go back to law school than to work for someone like that. Because I would have been like, Mom, I'm in the White House. Can you believe it? So cool. Yeah. I mean, I was literally like stealing stationery and this guy can't talk to his mom. and then the next day he calls me up and the volunteer guy calls me up and he's like, okay, I got another assignment for you. I know you really want to work in national service. Go work for Eli Siegel. And I go work for Eli Siegel. And this is a guy who walks up to me and is like, hi, thank you for being here. Thanks for doing all this hard work. My name's Eli Siegel. It's nice to meet you. And I was like, dude, of course I know who you are. You ran the campaign. And just the difference between those two individuals and their character and sort of who they were when nobody was watching really told me a lot about, it just taught me about like what it means to be a leader and who you can be. And so even if you don't have this like amazing gravitational shift in charisma like Bill Clinton, there are people like Eli, when Eli died very prematurely of mesothelioma, there were 1,000 people at his funeral and Ted Kennedy gave the eulogy. And he said in his eulogy, there are 1,000 of you in this room and every single one of you either thinks you're Eli's best friend or his very good friend. And every single one of you is right.
Life is full of what-ifs, some awesome, like what if AI could fold your laundry? And some, well, less awesome, like what if you have unexpected medical costs? UnitedHealthcare can help get you covered with Health Protector Guard fixed indemnity insurance plans. They supplement your primary plan to help you manage out-of-pocket costs. No deductibles, no enrollment periods, and especially no more what-ifs. Visit uh1.com to find the Health Protector Guard plan for you.
You should celebrate yourself every day, but some days you should celebrate with jewelry. Whether you want to commemorate an unforgettable moment or just bring some added sparkle to your collection, Blue Nile can offer you expert guidance and a wide assortment of jewelry of the highest quality at the best price. Go to BlueNile.com today and experience the ease and convenience of shopping Blue Nile, the original online jeweler since 1999. That's BlueNile.com. BlueNile.com.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Cats and cat owners deserve better than any old-fashioned litter. That's why I teamed up with scientists and veterinarians to create Pretty Litter. Its innovative crystal formula has superior odor control and weighs up to 80% less than clay litter. Pretty Litter even monitors health by changing colors to help detect early signs of potential illness. It's the world's smartest kitty litter.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
My business used to be weighed down by the complexities of in-person payments. Then, Tap to Pay on iPhone and Stripe came along and changed everything. With Tap to Pay on iPhone and Stripe, I streamlined my payment process effortlessly. Now I can accept in-person, contactless payments right from my iPhone. No extra hardware required. What's truly remarkable is how I can cater to all of my customers' payment preferences, whether they're using cards, Apple Pay, or other digital wallets. Tap to Pay on iPhone and Stripe ensure a smooth checkout experience every time. And it's not just me. Stripe helps businesses of all sizes, from local markets to global retailers, scale quickly and stay agile. To learn how Tap to Pay on iPhone and Stripe can help grow your revenue and reach, visit stripe.com/tapiphone.
As creators, we're always on the move. Whether it's a live podcast event, a pop-up shop, or a workshop, we're constantly interacting with community, and that's where Tap to Pay on iPhone and Stripe comes in. Imagine this. You're at a live event, a listener loves your merch, or a participant wants to sign up for your course on the spot. With Tap to Pay on iPhone and Stripe, you can accept their payments right there and then, right from your iPhone, so there's no extra hardware or no delays. Total game changer. It's not just for creators. Any business owner can do this. It's about making transactions smoother and much more personal, growing your business in your way. We've been using Stripe for our products and courses for a long time, and now with Tap to Pay on iPhone, you can take your business to the next level too. So visit stripe.com/tapiphone to learn more. Remember, folks, with Tap to Pay on iPhone and Stripe, your business is always at your fingertips.
So, can I ask you a question that maybe might be uncomfortable, and if it is, we'll go ahead and edit it out. But
I didn't know the interns.
I wasn't going to ask you if you knew them, but you speak so highly of Bill Clinton that I wonder, you know, the way you spoke about him as a woman in the era of Me Too, does your perception of that charisma and, you know, his leadership capabilities change? Like, what is your response to that? I wonder.
You know, it's really fraught for me, to be honest. When everything happened with Monica Lewinsky, I have a lot of photos with him and, you know, signed letters and, you know, part of the State of the Union that I wrote and all of those things that, you know, you gather in life when you do interesting things. And I have to admit that when it all went down, I took all of those pictures off my wall for about a year, a good year, maybe more. I was so disappointed. And honestly, it wasn't because of the affair. I felt like the affair was a divorceable offense, not an impeachable offense. I was more upset that he did it in the Oval Office. You know, I am such a deep believer in the power of leadership and of the power of the bully pulpit. I don't agree with much of anything Ronald Reagan stood for. That said, the man never took off his suit jacket in the Oval Office. Such was his reverence for the Oval Office. And I just, for me, and as you might imagine, I feel that similarly about our current president. The disrespect of the institution of government and the best and the brightest and what it can all mean, that was really what upset me the most about it. Now, that said, at the time, I was 25 and I didn't really understand the dynamics of men in power. And, you know, now I look back on it and it's like, yeah, it wasn't exactly consensual, right? I mean, it was consensual, but it's hard to say when you're president and the person's 20 something years old that anything's consensual. I mean, that's, you know, we don't even have full frontal lobes till we're 25. And the, you know, frontal lobe's the part of our brain that dictates good decision making. And, you know, somebody in that relationship needed to be an adult and it should have been him. So, you know, obviously for me, it's hard to say, you know, should he burn in hell? Is he the worst human being ever? I mean, I believe that there was a lot of good that was accomplished. I also believe he deeply abused his position. And I also believe he's not alone in that.
Yeah. Well, thank you. I appreciate your candor. Let's get into this idea of consonance. You referenced it earlier, and you actually wrote about it in the book. You said that consonance is the sense of frictionless belonging, of a momentous stride, of core relevance. It's a guiding force that reveals how your work, whatever that may be, contributes to your overall life's plan. Could you give us an overview of what you call the four elements of consonance?
Yeah. So, you know those moments when, like, everything that you're doing, it just isn't working for you. You're like firing on all cylinders and you're making it rain, or you maybe you're having a quiet moment with a loved one, or, you know, you're hosting this podcast, or it could be loud, it could be quiet, it could be private, it could be public. But you know those moments you have when you're like, yeah, like this works?
Yeah.
I think that's consonance. It's when what you do matches who you are. And what I learned in 20 years of interviewing people is that it really comes from some combination of these four elements. And each one of us at every age and at every life stage is going to need them and have them differently. So the first is calling. And calling is this thing that's bigger than you. It's like a gravitational force that gets you out of bed in the morning. It could be a business you want to build. It could be a bottom line that you want to grow. It could be a family you want to nurture. It could be a societal ill that you wish to call, that you wish to serve. But it needs to be something that's bigger than just you. That's the first. The second is connection. And connection is really the answer to why do you, in this job, in this box, in this organizational chart, in this company, matter? It's the sight lines and the understanding of why, if you called in sick to work tomorrow, anybody would care, right? Is your work actually connecting on a daily basis to trying to serve whatever that calling might be? The third is contribution. So we all want our work to contribute in some way to the life that we want to build. And if your connection is all about the work, contribution is really all about you. So how does this brand, this paycheck, this this company, its prestige, the way that it's thought of in the world, how does it allow you to manifest your values on a daily basis? How does it allow you to live the lifestyle or have the life that you want to afford? And how does it impact the velocity and the arc of your career trajectory? And then lastly is control. And control is just quite simply your own personal agency. So how much control do you have over how much your work is able to connect, how much you get to do that actually matters, and how much contribution it gives to your life as you're working towards that calling? And each one of us, as I said, at every age and at every life stage, it's going to be different. It's going to be different for me than it is for you. It's going to be different for you now than it was 20 years ago or 20 years from now. And I think part of the reason why we feel stuck is because there is a moment in time, usually when we're 15, 16, 17, 18 years old, where somebody says, pick a college, pick a trade, pick a path, go. And as I mentioned earlier, we don't have full frontal lobes at that point. And so, like, the joke's on us. We're asked to pick this path when we literally don't have the decision-making ability to make good decisions. And so we go along this way, and 10 years later or 20 years later, we look around and we go, is this all it is? Like, is this all I was meant for? Like, it was supposed to be right. Why doesn't it feel right? And it's because we start our career at some point valuing each of these four C's of consonance differently. And then we don't let that flex and change and grow and allow ourselves to flex and change and grow within it.
Yeah. Well, it's funny because you kind of read my mind when you mentioned, you know, what this would be like at 20 versus, you know, what would this be like at 40? Like, I'm going to be 41 on Thursday. And I think about how different the way I would make a decision about careers is now. Particularly, I always find it kind of absurd that we ask 18-year-olds to pick life paths when they don't have a lot of data points. Like, any decision-making expert would tell you this is inevitably going to lead to a potentially poor decision unless you're incredibly self-aware. So part of me wonders, why are we not Do you think we just don't have the capacity to look at our work through this kind of a lens when we're in our 20s? Because I can tell you, when I went to Berkeley, pretty much there were two things that determined how you were going to choose your work: prestige or the size of a paycheck. That was it. It was like, if you got a job at Google or McKinsey or a venture capital firm, you had made it, or you went to med school or law school. And people would think you were out of your mind to say that working at Goldman Sachs sounds like a shitty job.
I would absolutely agree. And even if we gave these 18-year-olds all of the data points, they literally don't have the mental capacity. Like, they don't have these frontal, like, they can't do it. Even if we gave them all the data in the world, and we don't have all the data in the world because we don't even know who we are at that point. You know, I had the same thing. You know, people were like, oh, they would talk in the hallways about people who got these great jobs at one of the big five CPA firms or at a consulting firm or, you know, on Wall Street. And then everyone else like, oh, they're going to be an artist. Right? Or they're going into, you know, they're going to be a journalist, or they're going into writing, or these like soft professions. And there was almost like a hush, like a, oh, well, good luck. Right? And it's ridiculous. And, you know, I mean, I hear all the time that the careers that my children will have aren't even created yet, that they're going to have to create their own path. And, you know, I mentioned my son who's fascinated by NASA. This is a kid who, in his spare time, he's teaching himself Russian with Duolingo because that's the language of the International Space Station. Oh, okay. Right? Like, that was not something that I would think about doing. That was never an idea. My younger son wants to go into hospitality, or he wants to design women's couture fashion. I mean, these are things that I think would not have been acceptable. Right. And you were just one of those kids who, like, oh, you're going to an art college. Oh, that's sweet. Good luck to your parents. And you move back home. Right. I mean, that was always the goal of parents was, I want my kids to go to college, get out of the house, and never come back. And that said, I would like my kids to go to college and never come back, but not because they can't afford it, because I think that's a healthy thing and I want their life to be good. But I think that we used to have the scorecard where we were supposed to decide jobs based on, like you said, prestige or money or the inspiration of the leader or the new skills that we might acquire or the scale of impact or where the job was located or what the benefits were, or of course, you know, like, how much does it pay? But and when I was recruiting, I used to listen for these motivating factors, right? I used to listen as I was talking to potential candidates. And these were candidates who, they didn't even know the job existed before me, the person, you know, who I also didn't even know existed, called them up. And so I was calling up these candidates, asking them to turn their lives completely upside down, move themselves and their families across the country or across the world to take these positions. And I was armed with this checklist of things that were mostly meaningless. And I would talk to them about the prestige or about the money. And the truth is, it would get them interested. And I knew that if I heard like two or three of them, they'd be like, yeah, okay, there'll be a second conversation. And four or five, I knew pretty much I could put them in front of my client. And if they were like six or seven or eight, like if they were totally into the mission and the impact and the new skills and all those things, I was like, the fish is in the boat. I am set. I'll move on to the next candidate. And then I would notice over time that my candidates would start to ghost me. These like beautiful, giant, robust, diverse pools of candidates would start to disappear. And it wasn't until I understood that I was bringing to them a list about the value of the job, but I wasn't bringing them a list about the value of the job to them, right? So if you're somebody who likes to go on, I mean, let me ask you, like, do you like to go on, you know, weekend getaways to beautiful cosmopolitan cities and stay in fancy hotels? Or are you somebody who likes to go deep into the woods and go camping and wake up next to the stream and look at the sunrise while you make your eggs, you know, over the fire?
Well, I would choose the hotel, but there's a caveat. If you put snowboarding or surfing in there, I would definitely choose that over the busy weekend in the city. So kind of somewhere in between, but I get where you're going with it.
Right. So the answer, of course, is summer without bugs, right? Either way, it's the bugs and the camping. But when I ask this question, when I speak, and I just spoke last week to 2,000 people in Calgary and 2,000 people in Toronto, in Vancouver, and I asked this question, and half the audience was like, yes, big fancy cosmopolitan city. And the other half of the audience was like, yes, I want to grow. I want to wake up with the bugs in the stream. And what I say to them is, if you think about the metric of money, this all-important measure of success, if I were to say to you, here's a job that's going to pay you a lot more money, but you'll have less vacation. So the only vacations you're going to take are those nice little weekends to cosmopolitan cities. You'd be like, great, awesome. If I were to ask you that, if you were the guy who wants to wake up at the stream, you'd be like, no, that's not going to work for me. In fact, I'd rather have less money, but more vacation because those far, you know, out camping places are actually harder to get to. And so, you know, we look at these metrics and we say, okay, well, I know on paper, those are the metrics that matter, but they don't actually matter to me. And so I can fill in those checkboxes and I can make the money, but I'm not really happy. And so the whole book is written with this idea of giving people a framework to actually be able to think about changing up the scorecard and making it a scorecard that works for them, particularly wonderfully, quirkily them, as opposed to everybody else's scorecard.
Yeah. So I want to come back to the idea of the scorecard, but I want to ask about something else you said. And you know, it's funny because I think in a lot of ways you've said this in really different and but very eloquent ways multiple times throughout the book. You said, we all have goals that we think of as our own creation, but the truth is that most of them were set by someone else. Your parents told you to get good grades in school. Your boss tells you to want the big promotion. Your friends and neighbors pressure you to score the right spouse, drive the right car, live in the right apartment, wear the right clothes in exactly the right size. And I wonder how in a world where you're literally inundated with everything that you're saying, from just scrolling through your Facebook newsfeed in a day to advertising to, you know, messages from all around us, and then layer on top of that all the social programming and stuff you receive from whatever your environment was growing up, how is it that you don't become a victim of your social programming, I guess, is really where
that's Yeah, I think that we get stuck in that. I think it's really hard to ignore everyone. And I think the first thing we have to do is just say, screw them, you know? I mean, I know it's easier said than done, but I think it is really difficult to live everybody else's life based on social media. You know, we all have those friends. I call them the Joneses. they're the ones with the super fancy Facebook photo and the super perfect, beautiful sunrise, vacation pictures. And you know them, right? Like you can picture them, you know, those friends, that you have, and everything always seems so perfect, and you know, it can't possibly be that way. And yet when we look at those pictures, we're like, well, maybe it is for them. Maybe I'm just doing something really wrong. And we spend a ton of time judging our own bloopers by everybody else's highlight reels. And then we wonder why we feel like failures. Well, I mean, of course we feel like failures because we're looking at everybody's very, you know, washed version of their success. And so I'd like to tell the story about how this year on the first day of school, my children were, they were such horrible human beings. They were just absolutely unmitigated disasters. And my children are normally lovely. They are great kids. I'm a really lucky parent. People tell me I'm a great mom, but I'm like, no, I just got great kids. I'm just along for the ride. They were terrible. They didn't stop fighting long enough for me to take that one most important proof point for social media that I'm the very best parent in the world, you know, like the first day of school photo.
Yeah.
And you know, I'm a working mother. And so it takes a lot, and I travel 150,000 miles a year. Like I am on the road a lot. So it takes a lot of fancy dancing to show up at, you know, those really important moments, like the science fair, do-si-do, or, you know, the parent-teacher conferences, do-si-do, and the first day of school, like do-si-fucking-do, right? Like that is the granddaddy of them all. And I did it every year for 13 years. Like every year for 13 years, I showed up and I was there and I took my kids to school and we took that perfect picture. And this year my kids were psychopaths. And and so I did what any good parent would do. I yelled at them with everything in my soul, like alien. I came out of my body. And I wasn't proud of it. But I didn't know what else to do. Like it was just one of those out of body experiences. And then we drove to school in stony silence with them fuming in the back seat and me fuming in the front seat. And I was holding back like tears of self-doubt and insecurity and disappointment and anger. And I was questioning every sacrifice I ever made as a mother, and especially every sacrifice I never made as a working mother. And all the while, of course, at stoplights, like a terrible person checking Facebook and looking at everybody else's perfect pictures of their perfect children. And then my kids got out of the car, leaving a trail of teenage angst behind them, which I'll tell you smells. And then I like fantasized the whole way home about all the ways I would punish them. Like, you know, you've seen those giant t-shirts with the two head holes, like our get along shirt. Like I'd stick them in that shirt, or I'd drop them off 20 miles from home and make them figure it out. You know, I'd take their cell phones away. And then I, that night at dinner, started lecturing them about all the ways that their behavior affected me and how it was disappointing and how it didn't reflect who we were as people and that we could do better. And my older son looked at me and said, you know, Mom, it was the first day of school. Like we were stressed, like new teachers, new friends, new classes, we didn't know what to expect. And my younger son was like, yeah, and Mom, you seem like you had a lot going on with work. Like, I know, you know, you moved stuff around to be with us, but like, I don't know that you really were with us. And that led us to a conversation about who we were as a family and who we were when we showed up for each other and how we uplift each other. And we decided that the next day we'd have a do-over. And we got up in the morning and I made breakfast. They showered. It was a success all around. And I got that picture. And of course, I posted it on Facebook. Uh-huh. I posted it on Facebook with this happy second day of school message about how it was actually in the letting go of everybody else's definition of success and ignoring everybody else that we were actually able to find our own definition of success. That our definition of success wasn't this idea of having everybody else's perfect first day of school photo, but it was in the grace and the love that we found in having the conversation about how we support each other. So that's kind of a long story to say that it wasn't until I decided to ignore everybody else that we were able to find that state of grace within our own family and define success for ourselves.
I love that. Wow. There's so many valuable lessons in that. I think that apply to not just, you know, parenting, but work and life. So one thing you mentioned earlier was this idea of a scorecard. And this is a question I've asked a number of people because of the fact that it's been on my mind a lot lately. And that is this idea of how we measure our lives, right? So Clayton Christensen wrote this amazing book in 2009 called How Will You Measure Your Life, which I think is far more relevant today than it was when he published it because of the fact that we can quantify everything. And one of the things that I started to see in my own life was, wow, like the way that I'm measuring has a really profound impact on my happiness and my well-being. Like if I measure my self-esteem in book sales and podcast downloads, well, then it's going to inevitably fluctuate because I'm measuring my self-worth in metrics that fluctuate. So I wonder at this point in your life, how do you measure your life?
Well, my book came out on Tuesday, so I'm measuring my life in book sales and podcasts. In there. It's addictive. It's addictive. I think I checked every hour for the first 3 days and then it was madness. That way goes madness.
Yeah.
So how do I measure my life? You know, I would like at the end of my life not to have one of those funerals where people talk about the titles that I had or the awards that I won or any of those things, but I want people to get really stinking drunk and tell stories about how their life was in some small way better because I had some part of it. I mean, I really do think that that's at the end of the day, all that matters. And I was having this very philosophical conversation with my husband about 6 months ago. And I was like, I'd had like one of those sort of scary medical tests that everything ended up coming back fine. But in those days when we were waiting, I was like, don't let people cry at my funeral. I don't want it to be sad. I want people to laugh and tell funny stories. And he's like, I can't control what people do at your funeral. I was like, yes, you can. You can control everything. Make me because I'm such a control freak. I mean, I sit in the aisle seat of every airplane, not because I think I'm going to live through like this fiery explosion, but just like even the illusion of control. Matters to me. So at the end of the day, I really do measure like my scorecard and how I measure my life is based on the small changes, the small hinges that you're able to provide for other people so that their doors can swing wide open.
Mm. I love that.
I just think there's always more money to be made. I think there's always different jobs to get. I think there's always more weight to lose. Like, I think that there's always more stuff to buy. Like, you can never catch up. And there are these four words in the English language that I think kill our dreams and make us unhappy before they even exit our mouths. Like, when they first cross our minds, this "I'll be happy when," right? I'll be happy when I get the job. I'll be happy when I graduate from college. I'll be happy when I get promoted. I'll be happy when I get married. I'll be happy when I get divorced. I don't, like, just be happy now. And I think that I come from a long line of women who have a very hard time leaving lunch before planning what we're going to eat for dinner. You know, I sit on the beach in the vacation. And I turn to my husband, I'm like, where are we going to go next? And he's like, can we just be here right now? And so I think a great measurement for our life is to think about how we can be happy in the now a little bit more.
Mm, wow. Wow. Well, I think that makes a really appropriate end-or conversation. So I have one last question for you, which is how we finish all of our interviews with the Unmistakable Creative. What do you think it is that makes somebody or something unmistakable?
Oh boy. I think that there's a voice that each one of us has inside. And I think that we spend a lot of time listening to the one dissenting voice and not listening to the 10 supportive voices. And I think what makes people unmistakably creative is to let go of that one nagging voice, whether it's, you know, the bully from junior high or the parent or the boss or the spouse or whoever it might be, or even in most cases, our own voice, and really just letting ourselves fail. I believe fully that failure is not finale, it's fulcrum. And I think that the ability to enjoy and see the failure as an opportunity to grow unleashes so much potential creativity inside each of us.
Amazing. Well, I can't thank you enough for taking the time to join us and share your story and your insights with our listeners. Where can people find out more about you, your work, and the new book?
Yeah. So I'm on all the socials at HeyLGO. That's HEYLGO. You can find me online at heylgo.com. If you're listening to me talk about consonants and you're wondering where to get started, I created a little quiz online. It's at limitlessassessment.com. And I'll say that again, limitlessassessment.com. And it takes about 10 or 15 minutes. It's a little intense, pretty catalyzing questions to get you really thinking. But at the end of it, you'll get a beautiful radar chart that has one graph that shows how much calling, connection, contribution, and control you currently have in your life, and how much of each you want to have in your life. And it'll give some tips about how to go about getting it. So that's at limitlessassessment.com. And of course, the book, Limitless, How to Ignore Everybody, Carve Your Own Path, and Live Your Best Life, is on Amazon.com, Barnes & Noble, and anywhere fine books are sold.
Awesome. And for everybody listening, we'll wrap the show with that. Thank you for listening to this episode of the Unmistakable Creative Podcast. While you were listening, were there any moments you found fascinating, inspiring, instructive, maybe even heartwarming? Can you think of anyone, a friend or a family member who would appreciate this moment? If so, take a second and share today's episode with that one person, because good ideas and messages are meant to be shared.
Small details are big surfaces. Tight corners are odd shapes. Flat, rounded, textured, or tall. Whatever your next project, there's a spray paint pattern that's just right. Because Rust-Oleum's new Custom Spray 5-in-1 gives you control with 5 different spray patterns, so you can tackle nooks, crannies, edges, and curves without worrying about drips, runs, uneven coverage, or anything else. Custom Spray 5-in-1. Only from Rust-Oleum.
Even on a budget, quality is non-negotiable. That's why Quince is the place to score high-end essentials at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Get your hands on buttery soft cashmere sweaters from just $60, Italian leather jackets, and so much more. And the best part about Quince? They exclusively partner with factories committed to safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Elevate your style without the elevated price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/upgrade for free shipping and 365-day returns.
My business used to be weighed down by the complexities of in-person payments. Then, Tap to Pay on iPhone and Stripe came along and changed everything. With Tap to Pay on iPhone and Stripe, I streamlined my payment process effortlessly. Now I can accept in-person, contactless payments right from my iPhone. No extra hardware required. What's truly remarkable is how I can cater to all of my customers' payment preferences. Whether they're using cards, Apple Pay, or other digital wallets, Tap to Pay on iPhone and Stripe ensure a smooth checkout experience every time. And it's not just me. Stripe helps businesses of all sizes, from local markets to global retailers, scale quickly and stay agile. To learn how Tap to Pay on iPhone and Stripe can help grow your revenue and reach, visit stripe.com/tapiphone.
Hold up. What was that? Boring. No flavor. That was as bad as those leftovers you ate all week. Keke Palmer here. And it's time to say hello to something fresh and guilt-free. HelloFresh. Jazz up dinner with pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Now that's music to my mouth. HelloFresh. Let's get this dinner party started. Discover all the delicious possibilities at HelloFresh.com.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Cats and cat owners deserve better than any old-fashioned litter. That's why I teamed up with scientists and veterinarians to create Pretty Litter. Its innovative crystal formula has superior odor control and weighs up to 80% less than clay litter. Pretty Litter even monitors health by changing colors to help detect early signs of potential illness. It's the world's smartest kitty litter.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
Imagine the softest sheets you've ever felt. Now imagine them getting even softer over time. That's what you'll feel with Boll & Branch's organic cotton sheets. In a recent customer survey, 96% replied that Boll & Branch sheets get softer with every wash. Start getting your best night's sleep in these sheets that get softer and softer for years to come. Try their sheets with a 30-night guarantee. Plus, get 15% off your first order at bollandbranch.com. Code BUTTERY. Exclusions apply. See site for details.
Have you ever felt a twinge of worry about AI taking over your job or diluting your creativity? Well, what if you could turn that fear into creative fuel? We've just published an amazing new ebook called The 4 Keys to Success in an AI World, and this is more than just a guide. It's a deep exploration into the human skills that AI can't touch, the skills that are essential for standing out and thriving no matter how much technology evolved. We're talking about real differentiators here like creativity, emotional intelligence, critical thinking, and much more. Inside, you'll find actionable insights and strategies to develop these skills, whether you're a creative person, a business person, or just simply someone who loves personal development. This isn't a story about tech taking over. It's a story of human creativity thriving alongside AI. Picture this, AI as your creative co-pilot, not just as a tool, but a collaborator that enhances your unique human skills. The 4 Keys ebook will show you exactly how to do that and view AI in a new way that empowers you instead of overshadows you. Transform your creative potential today. Head over to unmistakablecreative.com/4keys. Use the number 4, K-E-Y-S. That's unmistakablecreative.com/4keys. And download your free copy.